It's the Two Time Lives Podcast, episode number 62, the third and final segment of Live Lab number 3.
Finding inspiring, fresh ideas in time-based productivity is like searching for a needle in a haystack. Join Francis Wade as he works with a special guest at Two Time Labs in each episode to create something brand new. A product the world has never seen in a way that keeps you engaged and also challenges your thinking. If you are a productivity nut, a person searching for new ways to improve your time management, or one of the busiest people you know, well, this is the podcast for you. There's nothing else like it. Stay tuned. The latest episode from Two Time Labs is about to start.
Hi, and welcome back to the Two Time Labs podcast. This is the third part of Live Lab number 3 with Ray Sidney Smith. And I invited him over to build a interactive storage decision tool. Started off as a really long shot, but at the end of this episode, we've not only figured out how to manage long-term storage, but we also introduce a prototype of an interactive tool that we have developed. So stay tuned, stick around to the end, and click over to actually use the tool that we developed. There's a lot more coming in this episode of the Two Time Labs podcast. Okay, so if that's it for sort of local immediate data that's not immediately required but could be required in a few minutes, let's pivot then to the fourth kind, which is I have written here long-term archivable data. And I suggested that there's two kinds. One is the long-term equivalent of what we were just talking about, which is that you need the data in order to do your job. It may be too much or not appropriate to put it on your local hard drive. It may be in your local system, but you got to put it somewhere. And it has probably informational value that you need, like a huge database, for example. And you need it for your work. It's not appropriate to have it on your personal laptop or your personal hard drive only. It needs to be somewhere. And then there's also historical information, which is information like we were talking about before the call started, your 1990 tax return. So unfortunately, it was done on paper. But let's imagine that you scanned all of them going back. Keeping them doesn't cost you anything, but where do you keep it? Keeping it on your local laptop doesn't seem to make sense. It should be stored somewhere, saved in an archive somewhere, that you could access it if needed, but you don't anticipate ever needing it. So waiting a day or two to retrieve it doesn't bother you. And you don't want to have to physically move it around. Like, for example, every time you upgrade your local hard drive or your local, if you have a little rack like you do, a desktop rack, you don't want to have to download that information necessarily again to that location. You want it to be somewhere permanent but safe. You don't want to drag around and move around and have to manipulate information that you're only keeping just in case, and you really just want to park it somewhere safe without having to access it. So let's deal with the first one. I guess the first one, the reference information. Where should that be? Go ahead. I'm sure you have an answer.
But it really does depend upon the usage of that reference data. Uh-huh. So for me, I like to have some reference data on the ready. So I like to keep those things in some kind of archival system, but that happens to be closer to me than not. But if it's going to be how often, really I think about these things in terms of how often you need to access them. And the less often you need to access them, the more hoops you'll need to jump through in order to regain access to them. That's become simpler and simpler today because, again, of cloud computing and cloud storage. And so some of these systems may not seem different except to the extent that you kind of disconnect them. I give the example of emergency credit cards. So if you have a regular everyday credit card that you use, you may keep that one in your wallet and you go to the store, you use that card. But say that you have one specific personal line of credit and that has a credit card associated to it with it, but it's purely for emergencies. So you put that one, you know, in your home safe and it never leaves it. You don't know its number, the number, it's just there in case of emergency. That's kind of the way in which archival storage can be thought of, is that you're putting it in some place that is less connected to you and therefore less risk, because it's in a space where you know that it's going to be safe, and it's not, if you lose your, for example, if I lose my laptop, there are things that are not on here and I feel comfortable about it not being on here, so therefore I can still access it, some hoops to jump through, but ultimately I can gain access to it again. It's just a matter of how much time it takes to get to it. And so there are varying stages. One is some external drive where you're putting that, you're storing that information. Two
perpetually.
Is correct. Two is some kind of cloud storage system that's either you're manually moving that data, which is the way I prefer. I don't like automated backups for this kind of long-term storage stuff. I like to be able to decide, okay, once a month, I'm just going to move everything that's archival now, that is distinguishing that which was useful to me in the current storage space to now I no longer need it here, and it can move off of my system into long-term storage space, and that's going to move into the cloud. And then I have other systems where I take all of my data and it gets backed up and then physically stored off-site. And that gives me the level of comfort that, you know, there's any one of the number of quote-unquote acts of God or cyber criminal or what have you, and it's now not only off-site, but it's disconnected from the internet. So there's no way for someone to destroy that data because they don't know where it exists. And I like that level of comfort. Not everybody needs it. Not everybody wants it. But that's the level of comfort I want, is that I ship my data off to an off-site location so that it's there. And I know that perhaps it's not the most current data, but it's going to be everything that I care about in the long-term perspective.
It's like your mom's closet, huh?
You got it.
that's the kind of thing I do. So it's a non-internet. This is kind of like your total backup. Let's call it that. So you have a routine, I guess, for fulfilling this total backup. And do you use a company that takes a physical object from you and then puts it somewhere off internet?
So in my case, no. I'm literally physically moving that hard drive myself.
And you, like, trunk of your car, you take it over to what kind of place do you put it, if you don't want to tell us your secrets, secret spot?
Well, so there are actually multiple copies. So this is how we do it. So in any given moment, there are two copies. One is held offsite in a lockbox. So say, for example, you could do this by putting it into a bank, lockbox, a security deposit box, or you could just take it to someone that you trust, you know, say another colleague's office, and have a safe installed there. Again, the safe is off the ground so that, you know, it can deal with flooding, and flooding doesn't have to happen on just the main level. It can happen on an upper level floor. If the fire sprinklers even go up a couple of inches, that can damage a drive if it's sitting on the floor. So we want this stuff up off the ground, as high as you can. And you want it to be able to be fire safe, waterproof, and secured to the location, so someone can't just, you know, pick up the box and walk out of the location with it. So it needs to be physically secured to the premise and fire and water safe. I actually also have it inside of a magnetic enclosure. And so someone can't take a high-powered magnet and accidentally destroy data on it. And
you have people who would actually do that to you.
Well, so
ray terrorists.
Remember, an EMP, an electromagnetic pulse of any kind, can destroy data. And
okay.
And so think about it from the perspective that, in my case, where I have an office in the DC metro area, you have Secret Service that are constantly moving in and around where my office is. Well, one of the things you have to consider is that they actually have a deterrent system for president, vice president's motorcades. And those vehicles running in the Secret Service chain, one of the tools they have is an EMP device, a tool that will destroy the mobile devices that could potentially trigger a bomb or detonate any other types of incendiary devices around the vehicles of the president and vice president's motorcades. Whoa. Well, God forbid the president of the United States is driving by my office.
And they send out a pulse.
And they trigger one of these pulses to be able to stop some kind of, you know, defensive mechanism, and they destroy my hard drives. So again, I know this seems like obtuse for the average person, but you have to consider these things, that people have EMP devices for all kinds of odd reasons. And say, you know, a foreign dignitary comes and visits your town and they have one of these sophisticated devices on their machines and they send out these pulses and voila, your hard drive's dead.
And look, you're in the zone.
Exactly. And it doesn't take much to kill a device, like that. So, I want that level of you know, magnetic protection, and I'm trying to protect from all ends. You, again, the person listening to this may not care to have that many levels of protection, but just letting people know that those things do exist. And so it's inside of its own case that is shock absorbent, that protects itself from you know, that kind of magnetic disruption, and
fire, water,
and physical theft protection. And so there, at any given time, there are three versions of that archive: one physically held on storage premise, one that's moved off storage, and then one that's shipped off site. So, you know, put into the FedEx and it goes off.
Okay.
That one goes to a site that's far away. Right. And the point of it going far away is that if there is, for some reason, some kind of catastrophic event where the two local copies are no longer accessible, I want to have a copy that is accessible somewhere else where I know that person, you know, a trusted person to me, is able to reconnect that data to somewhere that I can have access to it on the internet again.
Well, and how often do you refresh these backups?
Every 6 months. It's done. So every 6 months. And in my case, these are trusted people that I know very well, you know. So in the particular case of the one, it's a colleague's business. So I know I have access to it. I have access to the premises of that business. I'm able to access my at any given time. So, you know, that's the comfort level that each of us has with each other. So that, you know, that person's data is on my site and vice versa. So we have, it's exactly the same for this person as it is for me. So we can, you know, put each of our data in these different locations. And that's just for short distance types of, you know, destruction. But then long distance destruction means that if some catastrophic event were to happen in the DC metro area, my data would still be secure.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How long does it take to retrieve the data if you realize you actually would need to use it?
Well, I mean, the data is now in the multiple terabytes, so that's, you know, it depends upon what data I need. So I would likely only have restored the data that was absolutely necessary. Mm-hmm. And we're collecting that data from many different sources. So we're pulling down data from G Suite, we're pulling data from Google Drive, which is you know, part and parcel of G Suite. We're pulling data from Evernote. We're pulling data from our other cloud systems, accounting software, yada, yada, yada. And so those are all being culminated together. But in an emergency situation where we're just looking for business continuity, likely all of our systems in the cloud are still running.
Right.
If we needed to restore any one of them because they were damaged.
So you would go to those first before going to...
We would only restore the ones that were necessary and then get ourselves up to date. Because they're there's between 1 and 5 months, 1 and 6 months worth of data that would be lost.
Okay, so you have that's an interesting concept, the total backup. I'm not sure many business owners think, because you're backing stuff from cloud services off the internet. You're backing every scrap of information, whether it's cloud, local, hard drive, I imagine smartphone as well, physical objects as much as you can in terms of taking pictures of them and shipping them off to a single location for sort of total storage. And then as you step down from that level, you're backing up all of your data to the cloud. You're backing it also to the external local locations. So you have something in your office, but do you have something half mile away where it's physically nearby, but not in the office? Do you have something like that?
Exactly. That's the colleague's business.
That's a total backup.
That's correct.
Okay. So you're sort of accounting for all information in, so that the focus isn't really on the nature of the information. It's that the focus is on maintaining the total backup in independent places and having access to the stuff that you need until you ever need a total backup.
Right, and the hope is that we'll never need it.
Okay. Interesting, because these are design rules, you know, that would go into a tool that would make suggestions for a user. It sort of says, okay, don't worry about it at this level. Just take care of it at the higher level, and it satisfies all the needs at the lower levels.
Correct. And one of the things that our systems do, one of the things that our system does is that when we reconnect one of those hard drives to the system, it actually does spot checks to see whether it can restore the data. And if it cannot, then it red flags it for us so that in the future we can look to see what happened in the prior backup to make that happen. Again, I've never had it not restore a file in its spot checking. So it goes out there and randomly selects files or databases and then attempts to restore it. And if for some reason it's not capable of doing that in the staging environment, well, then that's a problem. Right. So for example, this happens quite frequently in our website backups. So we back up our website, you know, the entire database and a copy of the software all comes offline. Well, when it goes ahead and puts it up to the staging site to see whether it can work, then we see whether or not a particular plugin failed to be reinstalled. And that tells us that either something happened and that bit of data then can't be restored. And why can't it be? So we may decide in the future to back it up differently so that we're pulling off, say, a full complete copy of the plugin as opposed to just the list of plugins to then pull from the data source and reinstall. And, you know, so little things like that. When we first started, for example, this is going back nearly 10 years now, I decided that, well, we didn't need the plugins. We could just reinstall the plugins from the plugin directory. Uh-huh. And then we realized that some of the plugins wouldn't be available to us at the time in which we needed them to be. So then we started pulling an entire backup of our whole, in our case, WordPress, the whole WP contents file. And then we decided, okay, well, we're just going to pull the whole directory. And we didn't care. We were indiscriminate about the entire directory because we wanted all of the files. And we didn't care if it was redundant. It's not that much data for us to care about storing the whole thing as opposed to just our WP contents folder. And that gave us a little bit more flexibility. Again, the plugins are within the WP contents anyway, but I was trying to be a little bit more judicious with what we were backing up because we could get the data from elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And we recognize that the value of being able to just copy one whole directory is more valuable to me than trying to be judicious about what to back up. And what we also realized that there
it's
were,
true.
Yeah, on the Windows system, for example, we learned that some of our folks, myself included, I make a lot of changes to our Microsoft Word template. So every Microsoft Office installation installs a base level template. It's the file that when you click on create a new Word document, well, what it creates it from is this background file that's a normal.dot or normal.dotx. Mm-hmm. Well, that normal file, that's where your personal dictionary is. That's where all of this data lives. And mine I think is like, I don't know how big it is, but it's probably bigger than, you know, multiple megabytes now. It's a pretty large file at this point. And the idea of losing it, because it contains all of these like saved snippets of text and contracts that I've created over time would be catastrophic to me. And I have I now have it in Google Drive in other ways, you know, in other automation systems, but still I want that file. So I have to make sure that when we do backups that we're saving these disparate location files so that they're also backed up and kept, because corruption happens. A normal.dot or dtx can certainly corrupt, and
bad upgrades can happen.
Exactly. An upgrade can cause a bad migration. So it's actually been much more useful to me than I thought it would be, just for those little kinds of hiccups that happen with regard to restoring data. So I say all of that from the perspective that you want to test the data. Just don't back it up and presume it's working. You need to make sure that it actually is data that you can use. If it's a file, it's just a matter of reopening the file from the archive to see if it can work. If it's on a DVD drive, you're doing high density backups to DVD or some other kind of flexible media. Remember, those are subject to the elements. So water damage, heat doesn't have to be fire. It could be very simply high. Yeah, exactly. Extreme heat that can warp a disk. And magnetism can destroy things. So think about how they can be destroyed and warped, and also think about how you can restore the files randomly just to make sure that things are doing what they say they're doing. Because you can't trust a backup provider to say that they're backing things up and that they can be restored. You learned that one the hard way.
Yeah, I learned that one the very, very hard way. I had to redo all these voice files because I was doing the audio version of my book. About 3 or 4 days last, which was not terrible, but hard work though to go and recreate that data. So this testing you're saying, it sounds as if one of the recommendations that must come out from this tool is that we recommend that people retest data on a periodic basis. But the question that you mentioned sort of, or the way you described the problem, the example you gave made me think that there's also there's reason to back up preferences. And this is getting down into the sort of the finer weeds, but I think they're becoming more important. There's app data as well, data that you use in a particular app on your phone or on your laptop that's user created, you created it, but maybe stored in the directory of the app, maybe stored in a directory of Windows. And your solution to that essentially is to say, back up everything. Because it may be easier to back up everything than it is to go hunt down all these different little nuances and then back them up. Is that accurate?
Yes. And many times when you think about a blob of data, just because it's a blob to you doesn't necessarily mean that it can't be translated or transliterated into a database format that can't look at it. When in doubt, Microsoft Excel or Google Sheets can do wonders to at least getting data readable for you. And so don't just think because you've exported it and it's looks like gobbledygook to you, that doesn't mean that you can't get the underlying data out of it in some way, shape, or form on the flip side.
Mm-hmm.
So I export you know, into JSON files and to other kinds of blobs that are indistinguishable to me right now, but that I know if push came to shove, I could find some database developer, hopefully my brother, who happens to be a developer, to write a little script that can translate the data into something that's readable for me. And that's also something that you want to think about on the front end, as we talked about before, is how is data stored? Is it being stored in an SQL database? That's great because SQL is you know, near universal, or MySQL, or one of these other databases. But if you learn that the tool that you're going to use is storing it in say, plain text files that are then encrypted, and that encryption is such that it's tied to your device, and so therefore when you take it off the device, well, it's just an encrypted blob. Well, that's going to be much more difficult to take a plain text encrypted blob and decrypt it. So, you know, like things like that. That's probably a very rare, you know, case. I hope that's a rare case.
Right.
but developers have done dumber things. So you need to be aware of, okay, well, how is this storing the data in what database, and would it be translatable out? If there's an export tool, is that export tool only to import into the same tool, or is it capable of being exported to another tool and therefore translated in some way, shape, or form?
GDPR compliant, for example.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Throwing it into some. Yeah, and you know, they'd have to go and reinstall the original program, which means you have to remember the name of it. I think I've lost a program or two trying to use a hidden file program, and then not being able to remember the name of the program, and then not being able to go, therefore reinstall the program, therefore losing the file.
Right. And some people keep a file of the installable, the .exe or the .dmg, of the version of the database that you're using, so that should, for some reason, you're not capable of regaining access to the version that runs your database. So, for example, if you have an Evernote database and you try to use it 4 years from now, that old database is not going to be able to work because the new software likely can't read the old database because there's too many versions in between.
That happened to me. Basically happened to me last week with WordPress doing a new upgrade, I guess, to 5.0, WordPress 5.0. Mm-hmm. So I clicked that button that said upgrade my website, and sure enough, it crashed everything.
Oh gosh.
So of course I had to go and reinstall WordPress using 4.9 something. And of course WordPress keeps all of its .exe files online, so you can go and do it. It took me about 15 minutes. I've done it before, so I wasn't totally panicked, but I had to do it. 5.0 right. Doesn't work.
You didn't see my blog post. You didn't see my blog post and all of my tweets to everybody saying, hold off on 5.0.
No, I missed that. You know, and I went against my instincts, because I always tell myself, never early adopt any of these things unless they're mission critical. And they never are. That's why I'm using Windows 7. It's not mission critical for me to go up to Windows 10. I went against my better judgment in this particular case, because it was saying nice, friendly, oh, are you? It's time to upgrade to 5.0. Click here, click here, click here. I saw it a few times and finally gave in, and bam, 2 hours lost reinstalling the old version. Actually, maybe that's something we should also recommend in our tool. Don't be in a rush to install new versions of software, because it can ruin your access to the databases that you need to do your day-to-day job.
Yeah, there's actually two sides to this coin, I'm in conflict over them, only because you need to make a choice again between security and convenience. Convenience for and security is auto updating. The sooner and the more updates that you do to your systems, the more likely that security bugs will be filled in. So right. I believe that all security patches should go into effect automatically. If your system can automatically apply minor updates for security patches, please do those. It'll keep everybody more secure, because if your system is compromised, that's a gateway drug to everybody else. And right. So you should definitely upgrade security patches. But regarding feature updates or major updates like 5.0 on WordPress, you should really hold off and let other people make those mistakes, learn from them. In the case of WordPress.org, they are in the process of already putting out the next version.
5.1?
Well, 5.0.1. And okay. it's some patches. You know, there's some bugs in 5.0. It's a big change, and I think a good move for WordPress. The new block-based editor, Gutenberg, as it's been coined, is going to be phenomenal, especially when it becomes a part of the front end for themes and widgets. I think this is going to be great. But, you know, nobody needs it right this moment. No. So, you know, you could put it off for a month, see what WordPress does, see how many patches and what things it works with. And in the meantime, review your plugins and themes to make sure they say that they're not just Gutenberg compliant, that they're WordPress 5.0 compliant, but that they actually work, right? Because you'll see people say, oh yeah, it said it was 100% compatible, and then I installed it and it crashed. And that's because maybe your theme was compatible and your plugin was compatible, but the theme and plugin were both not together compatible. So you need to be concerned about those kinds of cross-compatibility issues.
Actually, that goes for Windows as well. Similar logic, similar reasoning, that when you go to make major updates, think through it carefully.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
I always say delay by several weeks any features update. It's just an easy thing to do so that you can make sure that any bugs have been worked out. And if there's, like, for example, in the most recent versions of Microsoft 10, there have been some data loss issues where people applied features updates and then their systems deleted data. And if you just delayed the features update, you would have quickly learned that from the various news sources, and then you didn't lose data. And it was a very, very rare circumstance where that happened. But still, you know, you don't want to be put into that position.
No.
And in the case of Windows 10 non, I think it's, so what are the versions now of Windows 10? There's like home, and then there's professional, there's different versions of Windows 10. So whatever the versions that are the professional levels, you're capable of delaying the features updates, but the home versions, you're not. You don't get a choice to do that. So unfortunately, for those folks who are not capable of doing that, you're gonna get the update whether you like it or not. And so, you know, that almost pushes you to, in my case, I absolutely have the professional level versions, because I want that level of control. If I didn't already have it, I would have immediately purchased it just for that feature to delay feature updates.
Right. But that needs to be a part of our tool. And maybe that's what we should pivot to in the last few minutes that we have.
Okay.
We've covered the four major kinds of information and talked about different ways of tackling them. Let's talk about the thing in the middle that'll take all these inputs from the user. So we have the different kinds of data, the different locations that they could choose from. We have even some long-term trends they need to be aware of. That's, I guess, an input. An idea of how productive they need to be and how protected, how much peace of mind they want. Do they want Ray level peace of mind, or are they satisfied with a lower level of peace of mind? And how much costs are they willing to incur? So in general, to get to that particular level of peace of mind and time, I guess, how much time do they want to put into putting in this new system? And so they put in all these different things. And basically it's here is everything I want at the level that I want it. And we may indicate that there are some trade-offs, but we would ask them to be as realistic as possible. And the output would be, and in one instance, sort of a list of areas they need to update or upgrade or change. And that list could be converted into a calendar of activity that would then produce monthly sort of tasks so that they're not overwhelmed trying to get to whatever level they want next week and therefore not do anything. We would also include, I guess, some kind of, based on what you said, some kind of testing plan where they could go in and test different aspects of their system over time. So every month they could have something different to test, download a file from this backup resource and see if it actually works. Yeah, I guess that's what, and also I guess a list of, not quite rules, but there's some recommendations I think we would make around things like upgrading .exe files, that they do them, for example, after someone else has become the guinea pig and wait just a little while for the kinks to get worked out. And that could be a sort of a long-term, not calendar-driven recommendation, but one that's based on circumstances, that when this circumstance happens and you're offered this and this and that, do this, do that, do the other. Don't do this, don't do that, don't do the other. So that will keep your system so secure, but it would keep it working and maintenance, relatively maintenance-free. So those are the inputs, and those are the outputs. What's the thing in the middle?
Well, one of the things that I kind of like about the IRS, and I know that's a funny thing to say, but the Internal Revenue Service in the U.S., it actually, at the bottom of every instructions to any of the U.S. forms, tells you how much time it will take to complete that form. And so at each of the stages of implementation in this system, it would be nice to have some way to calculate, or at least just an estimation for how much time it will take.
And
more importantly, well, this may not be more importantly, but from my perspective as a business owner, I like to take my billable rate and plug it in and see how much money that means.
It's going to cost to you.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that sometimes will tell me, oh, I just need to hire someone to do this. So I try to look at every project in the business and determine how much time this will take, how much time it will take for me to do it at my billable rate, or how much time it will take if I just hired someone at someone else's billable rate. So, mm-hmm. you know, if I'm billing at $250 to $300 per hour and someone else is billing at, you know, $25 to $50 an hour, that's going to take 10 hours. It makes more sense for me to hire someone else to do that if it's going to be able to be done at 80 to 90% accuracy. Because even if I have to clean up little bits here and there, I'm still saving a whole host of time. Plus, if I'm billing hours, that means I'm making money. It's just it's an incidental cost. So right. I like to know that. Then what's the energy level that it's going to take for you to do that? If you're going to be avoidant, that is, you're not going to do it because there's overwhelm, if there's some negative association, if it's banal, if you're just bored by the idea of doing this project, then that also means that you're going to have a cost to it to have someone else do it, because you can't not have a strategy in mind, whether you're a consumer user or a business user. You have to have some understanding of the risk associated with this, especially with cybercrime and with other levels of potential risk to mm-hmm. losing data.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that needs to be in some way, shape, or form included. Yep. And
some trade-offs.
Right. And then
trade-offs. Mm-hmm.
Right. And then the costs of again, security and convenience, making those choices between the two are the things that you need to be aware of.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I don't know if that answered your what's in the middle question, but
it just added more stuff at the end.
And
more difficult. But,
yeah, good. and so the things in the middle are I guess specific to the tool.
Right.
What's the
tool is the question. Is it a decision kind of tool? Is it a choice as to what we're going to provide at the end of the podcast? At the most basic level, it could just be a long document. It could be as unexciting as that, except that I do promise my listeners that there'll be something interactive coming from the Two Time Loud podcast. So it could just be a volume of data that's available on an interactive basis. But I think we're going for more than that.
Well, so one thing that I think about is something that's maybe a modal that displays the various tools and comparison, maybe a comparison chart of the various tools in categories. So mm-hmm. I think of Dropbox, Box, Google Drive, OneDrive, SugarSync, Box, all of those as being similar to one another.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Evernote, OneDrive, Apple Notes, Google Keep as another class of in that note-taking space.
Mm-hmm.
And so like if we take each of these classes and give at least a comparison of their current features that match the ones that we talk about, whether that be the simple usefulness, aesthetically pleasing, connectedness, cohesiveness part, or the GDPR compliance parts or whatever, giving them comparisons so that they're able to see which ones check off the boxes as needed, then that gives them more information to make a decision. I'm not sure how complex the tool is that allows you to be able to kind of like check off boxes and see a comparison of a shorter list.
Let's imagine that even if we go on the cheap and what we do is we refer people to comparisons from around the internet on the different tools. Let's imagine that we do that and we find enough comparisons that we're satisfied with, so that they have a master list and they can make the trade-offs using their criteria. And we tell them what criteria to look for, but then they use the table. So we reuse tables that already exist. What if we imagine that?
Yeah, I think that would be great. Every 6 months or so, just need to go into the tool and make sure that those tables still exist,
right,
and if not, find a better one.
Right, right.
Because they will exist. I mean, you know, people will keep creating them because it's good content for SEO purposes. So then the goal is to link out to them, and then based on that, will they be picking one or several tools? So for example, there may be a long-term cloud-based backup tool that they use. There may be some physical tools that they are going to purchase.
Right.
Like an external hard drive. So linking out to those tools that are on Amazon or otherwise, or maybe a link to Wirecutter. Do you know Wirecutter?
No.
Okay. So Wirecutter is a New York Times owned review site, and they do hyper thorough reviews of products. So I would be very comfortable with you providing a link to, say, the backup drive that they recommend, because
they've tested the heck out of it.
Yeah, and they go through all of them. You know, they say these are the 10 we reviewed, and these are the stress tests we put them under, and this is why we chose this one as the best. It's very mm-hmm. very thorough. So physical drives, then cloud backup drives, ones that are touted as backup. Then they may choose an Evernote style reference note-taking tool, then they might choose something that was more a working solution, like a OneDrive matched with Office.com or Office 365, or Google Drive with Google Docs and the that suite. So,
but I'm wondering then, if given the number of choices there we are recommending they make, because it's a finite number of choices, but it looks to me to be somewhere in the 10 to 15 kind of range, based on some combination of what they have now and what they're going to be doing in the future. It might be, I think, too complex to try and link up the 10 to 15 choices. So if we leave them as discrete and say that they are standalone choices, we recommend that you provide the glue, but we won't provide the glue in the tool because it'd be too complex for us to do. Are we looking at 10 to 15 choices where we guide them along the choices they need to make. We provide some logic and we refer them back to the podcast and say, okay, here's the part of the podcast that we talked about this particular issue. Is it something like a course, like on Thinkific, which has 10 to 15 chapters, and in each chapter you make a choice, and we could leave a snippet of the podcast that refers to that particular choice in that chapter? Is it something like that? And at the end, they accumulate the choices and have an output document of some kind, something like that?
Yeah, I mean, I can easily see this being a Thinkific course where, for example, there are only a few tools that back up Evernote properly.
Okay.
And so walking people through how that works would be its own thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that would require a video tutorial and some other things. And I bet that if you did it properly, if you think of data in the data one area, that is, you know, these very discrete areas, how to back up email, how to back up contacts, how to back up documents, calendar, and so on and so forth. Each of those is its own lesson within a larger.
But I wouldn't provide that lesson, I don't think. I'm providing the rationale for taking the lesson somewhere else and learning it and applying it. It's the putting together that I think people have the biggest challenge. The part that you have hardwired into your DNA somehow. as I listen to you, you have an environment and an architecture for this environment already laid out in your mind in terms of the decisions you need to make in different areas, and then you put them together all at the end. That's the part I think people don't have. They don't see the entire ecosystem. They don't appreciate the trade-offs. They don't know how to approach the choice. And so therefore, they just don't make it. It's just too hard to figure it out. So, you know, to figure out what the criteria for the best external backup for your laptop is just way too hard, given the number of bits and pieces you need to have in the ecosystem. So the tool should give the person the ecosystem first and then direct them to the resource to make the particular choice at that moment in time. So it just give them design principles, I guess, and then say, okay, given, you know, the good attributes, the attributes to use in choosing an external backup for your laptop, go look for them in the following places, and these will probably change over time, and the number one choice costs X amount on this date, and it's probably going to go down, and it's probably going to, there's new companies coming in all the time, so we'll help them to make the choice, but they make the choice.
Right, and what I'm proposing to you is that at some later point, maybe there's a course that you develop or we develop together that could actually be for fee as a cost to someone. That's right. Called like How to Back Up My Life. And
right, and then, this is that sure is, because there's a person who's listening to us now, because we're the productivity geeks are going to be listening to this. If they've listened this far, listener, I'm talking about you. If you've listened this far, you are a serious productivity nut and you're committed to high levels of efficiency and effectiveness, and you don't want wasted time, money, and effort in your life at all. So you're someone who has exacting standards. And most people aren't at that level. They are somewhere in the middle between being total slackers and being productivity nuts. And those people, I think, would be a great, just to talk business for a while. Yeah, how to back up your life.
And I've never seen this. I haven't seen a comprehensive system that allowed you to, one, find the documentation that you should be collecting together, which, mm-hmm. again, I've spent many, many years identifying those documents and how to find them. Mm-hmm. And then the flip side to that is, how do you back up Facebook data? How do you back up LinkedIn data? How do you back up Quora data? How do you back up your email? Like, each of those individual things becomes a lesson. And instead of it being overwhelming to someone, someone just knows that over the next 6 months, I'm going to do each of these things, and it's going to teach me each of these lessons to back up my data and get through it over the course of time, as opposed to being overwhelmed by the sheer volume of these things. Because
and this is a perpetual training.
Yeah, absolutely.
You cannot stop.
No, so no, because there's always going to be a new.
Always, right. And stuff that's going to be obsolete.
There's going to be a new silo, and then, you know, LinkedIn or Facebook will be bought out again by somebody. Right. Well, LinkedIn already got bought out, but Facebook will get, you know, will change. Facebook will launch a new product. What happens when augmented reality becomes a data source?
Data, right. When do QAs become portable?
Right. Or these I'm having more and more Zoom meetings and people want them recorded. So now they're being...
Right.
They're being hosted by Zoom. Now I have to back up that data somewhere.
Or there's a breach.
Absolutely.
Someone gets totally decimated by, and you need to get off of that service as fast as possible. And you need to get onto a new one. Or a company goes bust and they give you 30 days to relocate all your data. Good luck.
Right. And
you don't need to.
Right.
That's the whole world.
Yep. And I've taken more time probably than the average person. I'm thinking probably 100x more time than the average person in preparing for those things. You know, like when people are like, oh my gosh, is Evernote going to fail? And is Evernote going anywhere? The answer is no, but I'm not willing to put myself in a position to be vulnerable. Right. So I've prepared myself for how to transition to two different tools should that ever happen. You know, I want to make sure that we move to Google Docs and or OneDrive should that ever happen. And literally, it will take me just a couple hours and I'll be completely migrated. And so I already know what's going to happen. So teaching it is not that big of a deal because, well, I've already done it.
It's in your DNA.
I built that. Exactly. So, you know, again, if we ever wanted to do that, I would be very comfortable with doing something like that.
Well, something good may have gotten birth from this particular podcast here at Two Time Labs. A good moment for us to turn this over to the universe and turn it over to our imaginations to see what happens next. Do you think?
Absolutely.
Great. Well, boy, Ray, this is, you know, I've wanted to have these podcasts develop serendipity. And this just delivered a big dose of it. So thanks so much for coming on the show.
Happy to be here, Francis. It's been a pleasure.
It's been great. Take care to our listeners. Thanks for hanging in here. This was probably a longer podcast than usual, probably a few episodes. And we appreciate your time and attention. And stay tuned. I got a couple of messages for you here at the end. And keep listening. Record off. Record. Hi, and welcome back to the Two Time Labs podcast. And in this third and very unplanned edition or episode of this very, very long project, a number of things have happened in the duration. First is that about 4 or 5 months have passed. And the reason they passed, well, actually, let me reintroduce Ray because I have Ray on the line. Ray, are you there?
Hey, I'm here.
And I know you're pretty curious, you know, to find out why it is that so much time passed and why I was so slow in getting around to doing this thing. But it turned out that there was no software to do exactly what I wanted to do. And I tried a number of solutions, got my nephew who is studying computer science involved, and eventually used a tool that involved some programming. And so I actually had to write programs to get this thing done, Ray. It wasn't easy.
It never is. Never is.
No, I think you deserve to pat me on the back or something. But
there's a virtual pat.
Oh, I can feel it. So it took a long time. I thought the software would be easy to find, or I could adapt some software I'd already discovered. But my knowledge of the software that I ended up using, which is called Twine, was way insufficient to what I needed to get it done. So eventually I learned how to use Twine at a high enough level, started to debrief the podcast, started to build a tool, and even though I understood how Twine worked, it still took a heck of a lot of time. I actually added up the hours, and because I capture all of my hours, Ray, so I know I could find out exactly how many hours, but I'm afraid to go and look because it took a lot more time. But the end result was something we actually just went over on video. So if you look in the show notes, and you're listening to this podcast, you'll be able to click and see a, I think it's about a 20-minute video, 15 to 20-minute video, which is a walkthrough of the final product, a digital storage tool. It's interactive, so you click as you go along. You enter your own information. You use the results of our discussion to create some plans for yourself. And at the end, it produces all of the data that you have entered, all of the plans that you have created, all in one handy-dandy page. So you can go ahead and make some actions based on all the decisions that we've prompted you to take during the podcast. Is that a sort of accurate way of saying it, Ray, what's got accomplished in this tool?
Absolutely. And I think this is one of those first round types of tools that allows you to create a quick and dirty checklist of the things that you need to back up in your life and potentially work. And it really does help you at least start to think about all the ways in which you can lose data. And then, of course, back the data up and recover it at a point in the future.
And if perchance you have not actually seen the video yet, so if you came to the podcast and this is the third in the series, I can promise you that we have woven into the tool a bunch of the different ideas that we discussed during the podcast, which Ray is, of course, the expert in, but I was very new to and was hearing them for the very first time. I had to give a name to one or two of them because we actually didn't name them. They just seemed like powerful concepts that need to be put in a tool of this nature. So it's a decision tool that should help you to come up with a decent plan for backing up all of your digital data, giving yourself a whole nother level of peace of mind, and actually also securing legacy items that you want to keep your hands on or keep safe for the duration of your life, things you want to pass on to the next generation, and give you a level of assurance that they won't be lost. And we hope you enjoy it. Ray, you want to say anything to sort of send us off at the end of this grand adventure?
Yeah, I think the other side to what you're talking about is really the idea that you are identifying your values as it relates to your data. And you will inevitably determine through listening to the prior two episodes of the podcast, watching the video tutorial, and then finally working with the storage decision tool to identify what is of value to you. And I think there's something highly productive about going through what exists in your world, because remember that physical, mental, emotional, and digital storage are all intertwined in some remarkable way and in some mysterious way. We need to recognize that the digital, physical, and mental, emotional, the psychic data that we all have in our lives is mysteriously connected to one another. And we need to make some value statements about what we keep and what we discard in our world. And that really is very, very powerful at the end of the day. So I feel like, you know, what you want to get done is very connected to the resources that you have at hand. And if you believe that the data you have is vital to you getting things done, to being more productive, then you should spend some time making sure that it's safe and that it's accessible to you when you need it.
Yes, that's so true. You know, it's one thing to talk about values at this sort of very high level, but I think what the tool does, based on what you just said, is that it operationalizes those values.
I couldn't agree more.
And that, my friends, has not been easy to do. So on that note, thanks for listening in to this very long and intertwined and bit of an endless journey. This is Francis and Ray. We're signing off from the Two Time Labs podcast. Thanks for listening in. And until next time, take care and all the best. Thanks for listening in to the third part of Live Lab number 3, episode number 62 here at Two Time Labs. If you'd like to support the work we're doing, simply click on the Patreon link below to make a donation. Don't forget to like our show on iTunes, Stitcher, Google, or whatever podcast app you happen to use. This is Francis Wade signing out, the Two Time Labs podcast. Until next time.